You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
all allies express their strong support for Turkey, and we stand all together, united in solidarity with Turkey. And all allies also condemn terrorism in all its forms.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says all the obligatory things as Turkey calls a summit under Article 4. But will other NATO members be worried that the treaty is being used as a fig leaf for renewed war against the Kurds? My guests, Roger Boyce and Jeffrey Kaufman, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including
Africa and its people teach us a powerful lesson that we must uphold the inherent dignity of every human being. Every person has worth. Every person matters. Every person deserves to be treated with decency and respect.
President Barack Obama's address to the African Union, in which he tells his fellow heads of government to renounce corruption, embrace human rights, and quit when their time's up. But was the applause any more than polite? And on the subject of high-flown speeches about intractable problems,
there is no place for dirty money in Britain. Indeed, there should be no place for dirty money anywhere. That is my message to foreign fraudsters. London is not a place to stash your dodgy cash.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron wants to stop London's property market from being used as a money laundry, but can he? And we'll also look at what kind of justice has been done in the case of one of Libya's governments versus Saif Gaddafi. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor of The Times, and Jeffrey Kaufman, the journalist and commentator. Welcome both back to the show. Now, ambassadors from 28 NATO countries are meeting in Brussels today at the request of alliance member Turkey, which for only the fifth time in NATO's history, although the fourth time in Turkey's, has invoked Article 4, which allows for the summoning of such a conclave when any member country believes that its territorial integrity, independence, or security is threatened. Roger, I'll ask you, first of all, this presumably falls under the security category, because Turkey can't possibly imagine that its territorial integrity or independence is threatened. What do they hope to gain from this summit?
Well, I think it is arguing that its territorial integrity is threatened. It's not, you know, there are two critical articles, Article 4 and Article 5. Mm-hmm. Article 5 is collective defence. That's when you are gravely, directly threatened. Article 4 is kind of, as you can see, ambassadorial level. It's supposed to summon up interest, alert your alliance partners that that you expect solidarity, an expression of solidarity for something that's about to happen. But in truth, it's not, the alliance is not really involved very much in this at all. It's basically being worked out between America and Turkey. And the NATO is just really a fig leaf in all of this. It's America that, and American air power, that's going to clear out this so-called safety zone along the Turkish border. And it's America that has largely got issues with Turkey about this and how it's supposed to go forward.
Jeffrey Kaufman, the backdrop to this obviously is Turkey suddenly taking a much harder line on Islamic State following last week's bombing in Suruç, and also taking the opportunity to take a whack at the PKK while they're at it. I think it's probably a safe assumption that none of the other 27 NATO countries are that bothered about them bombing Islamic State. How nervous or uneasy are people likely to be about NATO being used as a cover under which to renew war against the Kurds?
I can't help but thinking, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, that Article 4 is a cunning smokescreen or fog by the Erdogan government to distract and really to co-opt NATO. Because Erdogan, this is a really fascinating and distressing game of chess that he's playing. On one hand, we've been waiting for Turkey to step up and fight ISIS, and now good news, they're doing it, but guess what? They're bundling in the package hammering of the Kurds in Syria, in Iraq, fearing that the Kurds, after all, have been fighting ISIS. And so Erdogan sees the calculus as this, that if we let the Kurds continue to succeed while we hammer ISIS, then that emboldens the Kurdish separatists in Turkey. And remember, the Kurds are the largest ethnicity in the world without a nation.
Indeed so. Roger, this is the tricky bit, though, isn't it? Because if we're looking at the sort of international struggle against Islamic State, which does seem to unify pretty much the world more or less, the Kurds are not only basically on our side, they have been leading the fight.
Yes, I mean, I wonder how you feel now as a Kurdish soldier, you know, who's been sort of presented by Obama himself as a kind of hero, you know, a model of tolerance, basically... You know, the ersatz ground troops of the alliance, trained by the Americans, trained by Europeans, even supplied by them. You know, they're ready, up and going. And now, guess what? America's given the green light for Turkey to bomb them. I mean, that sounds like a big problem for America and alliance management and crisis management
and
to me.
Certainly the Kurds would not perceive this as the first betrayal by America in their relatively recent history.
This is just another one of those examples in real politics that completely shatters the people with ideals. And it really, you know, it has to do with sort of what is the bigger priority. And Erdogan darn well knows that the world needs Turkey to fight ISIS, and he now knows that it's taken him a while, but that Turkey needs to suppress ISIS too for its own security. But he's also calculated that he can get away with more, and so his own personal agenda and his own nation's or leadership's political agenda is being bundled into this. And you know, we see this all the time in history, and it's never happy and it's never comfortable, and it's, you know, and it's really hard to stomach. You know, you look at not far away at Qatar, which happens to host the Fifth Fleet of the US, key strategic a partner for the U.S. Qatar gets away with so much because of that, and they host Al Udeid Air Base for the U.S. as well. Because of that, the U.S. deals with Qatar's violations and human rights excesses much more tenderly than it does other countries.
Tenderly is a lovely choice of word in the circumstances. Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu, said yesterday, I thought it was a curious comment, he said, there is no difference between PKK and Daesh, by which he meant Islamic State. You can't say that PKK is better because it is fighting Daesh. Now, Roger Boyce, you kind of can, can't you?
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah, that's kind of an absurd thing to say. What they mean is we have a battle on two fronts. Yeah, okay, well, we knew that, and we knew that they'd prioritize it in a certain way. I mean, what's changed only in this day, apart from the explosion last week, is that America has put on much more pressure to use Incirlik, the airbase, Turkey has understood that it really does have a bargaining chip here, and it wants what it's always wanted, which is a no-fly zone along the Turkish-Syrian frontier, and that's what it's going to get. I mean, it's going to be called something else, but that's what it's going to get. So it's done okay for itself. It's done okay for itself, and of course, you have to, you know, it's not. They haven't just started to demonize the Kurds. You know, there's been, you know, 3 decades of hate speech about the Kurds and the PKK. So there's nothing new about that. But what's changed is this the subtlety of this negotiation about this airbase.
Okay, well, we need to move from Brussels to another diplomatic bun fight, this one in Addis Ababa, where Barack Obama today became the first president of the United States to address the African Union. Not for the first time, Obama gave every impression that he's rather enjoying the twilight of his presidency, taking the opportunity to deliver a few home truths to his audience. He focused on the positives, as he usually does, but he also observed that Africa was still far too subject to bent and incompetent plutocrats who don't know when to quit, although he did, of course, put it slightly more tactfully than that. Jeffrey, is he more likely to be listened to by other African leaders than other American presidents might have been?
You know, I heard his speech today to the African Union, and I have to say, you're right. He is enjoying himself. He really, it's about time, you know, almost 7 years in, and he's finally found his
well,
mojo.
He's not running for anything.
He hasn't been running for anything for a couple of years.
This is true.
You said in your opening notes, your opening headlines, you know, was the applause tepid? I didn't think it was at all, actually. I actually noted, who am I? I was just listening, but I thought the applause was actually quite strong and quite approving. I think that, to answer your question, Obama is uniquely positioned in it. And it wouldn't surprise me if what we are seeing on this trip is the beginning of Obama carving out his post-presidential legacy. Obama is uniquely positioned as an African-American, soon-to-be ex-American president, to talk about issues of governance. And he was pretty bold. You know, in Nairobi, he was bold in a different way. But, you know, he's clearly about corruption. He's telling these guys, listen, he was quite funny. And he can be, actually, surprisingly.
He's a very funny man.
Yeah, I mean, but he was saying, you know, I could continue in this job, but the Constitution doesn't let me, and that's a good thing. And you people need to do that too. And you know, he's using his kind of jocular, y'all folksy kind of language. He's making the point that we know, folks, we're watching. Will it change? It's not going to change overnight. These guys have, you know, they're in power, but he may be positioning himself now to be a kind of arbitrator, middleman, leader on the issues of governance in Africa. It's really interesting.
I mean, Roger, everything he spoke about was everything that becomes obvious to anybody who spends longer than about 20 minutes in sub-Saharan Africa, that there is enormous human potential there, absolutely immense potential of all sorts, which is hamstrung by all the obvious things that everybody realizes are problems: the corruption, ethnic division, the lack of rights for women, poor human rights in general, quite frequently ghastly treatment of gay people. How much difference does one speech make to any of that? Is there a small ball set rolling here somewhere?
I don't think it makes any difference at all, to be honest. And it's, I mean, the reality is, well, first of all, I must say on Obama that he may be speaking out quite effectively on human rights at the moment in Africa, but he's kind of ignored it in every other element of his foreign policy. You'll notice that while the Iranian nuclear negotiations were going on, 690 people were executed in Tehran. I mean, sequentially, not on one day. Cuba, you know, human rights abuse is still going on, and so on and so on. So, you know, human rights has slipped off his agenda, except in Africa. And I think if I were one of those leaders listening to him, I'd think, well, he's just picking on Africa again. You know, who ends up in the International Court of Justice? You know, where do the warrants come? It's African leaders, you know, because Obama has really nothing to lose, and Western leaders have nothing to lose by saying that Africa is immensely corrupt and backward and so on. Well, you know, we know that's not quite the story. We know it's an incredibly dynamic, growing place, and you know, mobile phone usage and all these kind of things. We know all that, but we also know that governance is rotten. So when the American president comes and says it's rotten, do people sit up and take notice? I don't think they do. I think they think, this guy's picking on us.
I have to disagree. I think that it's interesting you single out Cuba. If you listen to the very, very interesting interview that Obama did with the BBC this week, he talked about about why he's doing this. And he said, listen, you know, we're better to work with these people. We're better. Isolating Burma for all these years, isolating Cuba for all these years did nothing to help human rights. By opening up and by slowly pushing the standards, we have a chance at improving things. Surely you wouldn't argue that isolating Cuba for another 50 years would be better for human rights there. And in the case of Africa, I think that raising the discussion is a beginning point. Will it change anything overnight? Of course not. But you know, one of my experiences covering politics internationally as a journalist is that particularly in the developing countries, people really do at some point worry about what's being said about them, particularly by prominent people, and they take note, and the people around them take note. And that doesn't lead to a change overnight or next month, but it leads to a subtle change, and it really depends how the conversation moves forward. But I think it's fair to attack him or to hold him accountable for his lack of action in Africa in the first two-thirds or first three-quarters of his presidency. But I don't think that's reason enough to dismiss what he's doing now as inconsequential.
No, but the question is, will it have an effect? And the answer is no.
Not one speech. No, I agree. But I think let's see where he takes this.
What have we made of his record on Africa in general? Because I just wonder if he's... A curious statistic I dug up was that George W. Bush made 10 trips to sub-Saharan Africa as president. This is Obama's fifth. You're looking
at me
quizzically, Jeff. I'm pretty sure.
Right. Is that right?
Yeah, George W. Bush spent a lot of time there. Has Obama been, ask you first, Roger, has he actually been, ironically, felt somewhat hamstrung by the very fact that he is of African descent, not to look too much like he was too interested in Africa?
Well, honestly, I think he's a bigger man than that. I don't think that these kind of Republican smears at the beginning, you know, and these kind of issues, I don't think that would inhibit him. No, it's a question of where he's... I mean, he started his presidency with a different premise. That's to say that he would bring peace to the world, starting with the Middle East, and then the Arab Spring happened, and that was all derailed, you know. And then other things derailed him, and that's unfortunately the history of any presidency, really. But it's particularly the case with Obama's at the end of Obama's first term and the beginning of Obama's second, which is Russia, Putin. All these things have basically hijacked the agenda, and Africa, as usual, slips off it. And I think that's all it is. I think it's slippage. But I don't think that's absolutely critical. And I disagree that African leaders are somehow incredibly sensitive to international pressure. I don't think that's right. I don't think they are brand sensitive in that way, because they know that investors will always come because economies are thriving, economies are growing, and they come because they're commodity rich. And they quite often take the government corruption in their stride when they do so. And that's the problem. It's a question of how to structure that relationship with Africa that takes some of the bad things out of the trading relationship.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Roger Boys and Jeffrey Kaufman. Coming up next, we will look at justice after a fashion in Libya and examine dirty money in British real estate. Do stay tuned.
Monocle has a new offspring. The just-launched Escapist is our sunny summer title with a travel vibe. Printed in the same compact format as our winter forecast, it takes you to 10 great cities that should not be missed. Let's get the Monocle team to tell you more.
Our Nairobi correspondent Trista McConnell takes a trip to Djibouti, the tiny Horn of Africa nation with one of the largest concentrations of foreign military bases in the world.
We also head to Ethiopia to discover the country's booming capital, Addis Ababa. There we encounter a city undergoing dramatic change as investors and foreign money pour into the country.
The Escapist is on newsstands now. Get your copy today or become a Monocle subscriber at monocle.com and never miss out.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are today's guests, Roger Boys and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, for the attorneys conducting the defence of Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the deprived heir of the unlamented colonel of the same name, it was always going to be uphill work. And indeed, to nobody's surprise, a Libyan court has today sentenced Saif to death by firing squad, along with eight other associates of his late father, including Libya's former intelligence chief, Abdullah al-Sanusi, and Prime Minister Baghdadi al-Mahmoudi. Carrying out the execution execution may not be straightforward. However, Saif is currently the guest and or hostage of a rebel group in Zintan. Jeffrey, in fairness to all concerned, four defendants actually managed to be acquitted. But that notwithstanding, does this give any impression of having been a remotely fair trial?
No, not at all. and it's really tragic. The ICC wanted to put Saif on trial in The Hague and give Libya a real sense of proper justice and full and transparent justice in front of the international community. As you've noted, he was captured by the Zintani rebels or militia, and they haven't let him go. He's been he's a real ace in their hand. And meanwhile, he's tried in absentia, 100 miles away, through video link that breaks most of the time. He wasn't even able to witness most of his trial. It is unfortunately, like everything in Libya these days, a circus, but there's nothing amusing about it.
Saif Gaddafi, of course, was at one point supposed to be the moderate Western-looking future of Libya, and in that capacity, I in fact took afternoon tea with him at the Ritz in about 2000-2001. Seemed an affable enough kid. Roger, what do we think went wrong? Did family loyalty just get the better of him eventually?
Well, I think it all started to go wrong when he went to the LSE, probably.
Of how many people can that be said?
Well, quite a lot. he was bright. Yeah, he was bright, vain. You know, he had his playboy elements as well. He was a rich kid.
His dreadful paintings.
A rich kid, you know, yes.
He did fancy himself as an abstract painter.
Yeah.
I went to an exhibition of his works, which were terrible.
Yeah. Well, I think he was more than a bad painter. I think he was probably a nasty piece of work as well. I don't think we should over-romanticize him. In fact, all the people in the dock had their moments. In particular, the secret police chief. Going way back, 1988, you know, all sorts of nastiness, you know, the gunning down of a prison massacre in 1988, something like that, something horrible. Anyway, you can't really shed a tear for him, but yes, it was a show trial. Yes, how can Libyan justice be in any way credible when they haven't got a government, you know, a unified government? It's a problem of whether one should in some way. The problem is that if you don't have a coherent, central, credible government, then the powers of the International Criminal Court to actually take someone and put them on the trial are very limited. You have to deal with a government, and you have to deal with a proper judiciary, and Libya doesn't have it, and that's how he's ended up where he's ended up.
This is in many ways Gaddafi getting the legacy exactly what he wanted. He set the country up to fail if he wasn't in power or his successors.
That was always his argument. I may be terrible, but what I'm holding back is worse.
My son's even worse.
Right, yeah. And because he created no government infrastructure. It was shocking. I spent a lot of time covering the so-called Arab Spring in Libya in 2011, and you know, there was a country bringing in roughly $1 billion a week in oil revenue, and the poverty. I mean, Tunisia next door, which has very little oil, you know, Tunis is a much more prosperous city. I mean, Tripoli is just shockingly poor. And I was also there around the time that Gaddafi was killed. It's hard to feel sorry for him, given what he did to others. The problem was, and it was very apparent then, that when essentially a lynch mob murdered him, it set a tone that this is rough justice, that this country is open to rough justice. It would have been so much better had he been captured and handed over to proper authorities, et cetera, et cetera. It would have set an example. But that was not to be, and this is not to be, and this is all part of the same pattern, and it is not a good one.
By the way, we don't actually know whether the sentence will be carried out. I mean, he's still a captive of the Zintan militia.
He's still entitled to appeal, I think, as well, for all the good that's likely to do him.
And he has an appeal, yeah. No, and we mustn't forget that Cameron has used his Southeast Asia trip now to raise the possibility of bombing Libya again, or at least taking military action in Libya.
Who does he bomb? Just as a,
well, he's I mean, he's talking about the training, the ISIS training camps, which
right. And this is why it really matters. And Libya is so close to Northern Europe, or to Southern Europe, sorry, and the anarchy there, just the power vacuum, the void, leaves things wide open for the kind of this extreme radicalism of ISIS to get very close to Europe's shores.
Well, on the subject of David Cameron, the British Prime Minister has chosen the curious location of Singapore to declare himself the last person in Britain to have noticed that London's property market has been grotesquely skewed, especially in its upper reaches, by foreign buyers who may not have come by their fortunes entirely honestly, using Hampstead Mansions and Mayfair Apartments as deposit accounts. Cameron said, "I am determined that the UK must not become a haven for corrupt money from around the world." Roger, is he essentially saying, "I am determined to shut this stable door"?
Which has made us all so rich, you mean?
Well.
No, I mean, well, first of all, he said it, the unanswered question about why he said in Singapore is because, frankly, you can get nicked for chewing gum and leaving it on the pavement in Singapore. It has a kind of anti-corruption profile. I don't know how pucker it is, but that's the way it stands. No, I mean, I'm, to be honest, I'm against the whole of my journalistic biography. I'm actually kind of pro-oligarch a little bit on this. I don't see a fund... Well, first of all, I think the amount of money is being exaggerated. It revolves around a very technical issue about land registries and who is registered as the owner of property in London. It seems I have no fundamental problem with shell companies owning property, and it's a great populist issue in London. It plays into all sorts of domestic political agendas here. But actually, I don't see that there's anything really fundamentally wrong apart from a violation of good taste quite often in these places.
Oh, I think Roger and I are going to have to agree to disagree. I find it vile because I think we know that we are that allowing these shell companies based in British Virgin Islands or Jersey to filter stolen money and to park it in the most secure place imaginable, London real estate in Mayfair and Westminster, with no accountability, no really making it very difficult to trace its origins. This is money laundering by a different name.
Shell companies are quite legitimate tax avoidance.
Sure, but we know that a lot of them are being used. But we know that a lot of them are being used by Russians, Nigerians, others, with money that was not theirs in the first place, and they now park it and they cleanse it by owning a mansion rather than hiding it in Swiss bank accounts.
We can't always establish that, though.
Well, exactly, which is why what Cameron is doing is necessary, because you're right. If these shell companies are legitimate, then let it be seen. But I don't know why London needs to lie back and let itself be exploited, shall we say politely, used for the purposes of making stolen money clean and in the process totally perverting the value of real estate for people who actually want to live here.
Yeah, well, that's a shame, of course, but we mustn't lose the nuance in all of this, I don't think. I mean, a lot of these Russians, for example,
but it's so interesting that you attack,
are rich.
But I'm so fascinated that you give him a pass, Cameron, or the oligarchs a pass on this, and yet you take Obama to task on human rights. I think this is a human rights issue. I don't understand the consistency of the argument here, Roger.
I mean, Roger, you would surely concede that David Cameron does face a problem that in London especially, property is ruinously expensive.
And we're supposed to blame foreigners on this.
Whether or not this is the reason, he is obliged to be seen to be doing something.
But you're also seeing the death of parts of the city. You walk through Belgravia on a weekday night at 8 p.m. when most houses in most cities would be alive with life, and the city, the houses are all shuttered. There is a concern about the ability of the city to function. When you hear restaurant owners in Westminster saying, "There's nobody living here, we're closing doors."
Well, but Belgravia's always been shut at the weekends because, you know, I'm rich Englishmen go to their Wiltshire
weeknights. I said Tuesday night.
Okay, well, Tuesdays, everyone shutters up on Tuesday. But anyway, but my point is simply this, that a lot of the Russians who have shell companies are not necessarily dodging our judicial system. They're dodging Putin, yeah? They know how easily their assets can be seized and are constantly being seized by a rapacious regime. And so, of course, they bury money into shell companies, and the money ends up here. And I'm wondering, is that really such a terrible thing?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Well,
I don't live in Belgravia, so I have a slight advantage over you, I think.
We will
have... Nor do I. I can't afford it because they've bought all these places.
We will have to leave it there. That is all for this edition of Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Rebello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Melkin Charchoglian, and Eugenia Elenskaya. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Thanks, of course, also to Roger Boyce and Jeffrey Kaufman. Up next, Christopher Lord is in our Istanbul bureau with our international playlist. Josh Fennett follows with Section D at 1900. I'm back with the Daily at 2200 with Emma Nelson. Midori House returns at 1800 London tomorrow. But for this edition, thanks for listening. Goodbye.